And then there were five. The Senate GOP primary gains another candidate. Jerome Adams appears before the Senate. That plus ACA funding threats and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending August 4th, 2017.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, State Representative Mike Braun announced he'd join the campaign for the GOP nomination in Indiana's 2018 U.S. Senate race.
We've never regretted.
Braun joins a crowded GOP primary with U.S. Representative Luke Messer, businessman Terry Henderson, attorney Mark Hurt, and educator Andrew Takami. The Jasper Republican has served two terms in the Indiana House. He owns a distribution company that, under his leadership, has expanded nationwide. In the House, he's increasingly been looked to on business and economic development issues. Braun joins a race that's been marked by vitriol between Congressman Messer and U.S. Representative Todd Rokita, who's not officially declared as a candidate. Is there a path to the nomination for Mike Braun? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers, John Katzenberger, president of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute, Democrat Ann Delaney, and joining us as our new regular Republican panelist, Mike O'Brien. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Well, first, Mike, welcome to the regular chair, and I just want to know, are you excited to be shouted at by Ann on a more regular basis?
I am, yeah. It's the highlight of my weekend. I mean, you roll right into the weekend the right way.
All right. So,
get you thinking straight.
Yeah, that's right.
So Braun is theoretically capable of significant self-funding in his campaign. Could that be his path to victory?
Sure, one of several paths. You may recall that a little-known Tennessean moved to southern Indiana a couple years ago and spent $3
Tennessee
million
Trey.
Of own money. Yeah, now we call him Congressman.
We call him right? Congressman Tennessee Trey.
So there's a way to do it, right? Money is certainly a big part of this. It's different than running for Congress. You've got to really have a statewide organization. You've got to kind of be embedded in the county organizations, have county coordinators, get signatures. I mean, it's a much higher bar to run statewide than it is to run for Congress. But Mike Braun has made a great name for himself quickly in the legislature. He's an accomplished business guy. And he does kind of create a contrast in a field that is really currently dominated by two incumbent congressmen who are running on their records and their case to go take on Joe Donnelly contrasts their record and their work in Congress against his. So he kind of stands apart from them, and so that's another path for him for sure.
We've talked about this before, but the sort of vitriol going back and forth between Messer and Rokita, is this evidence of others thinking that they see a path because of that?
I think that's clear. I mean, they've behaved so badly, so early in the campaign, that it's almost an imitation to other people. And Mike Braun can, as I understand it, self-finance. And that makes a big, big difference in this, especially in, I would think, if it were a party organization person against one outsider, that would be a tremendous advantage. But if you're going to have four or five or six people in the primary, money is going to count, and it's going to be difficult to raise for either Messer or Rokita, if they can even stop fighting each other in the meanwhile to figure out what they're going to do. But the contrast is there. My impression of Braun's record in the legislature is that he's more moderate, that he's more willing to take the less ideological position. That certainly isn't true of either Rokita or Messer. They've been hard right the entire time they've been there. So it would put a more moderate part of the, you know, more in the sense of Richard Lugar, certainly, than Richard Murdoch, which is what both Messer and Rokita represent.
But can more of a Richard Lugar type win an Indiana Republican primary anymore?
Well, that's the big question about the primaries, because the primary traditionally, especially on the Republican side, has been dominated by people who are further to the right ideologically than a moderate. And we saw that happen in the Murdoch-Lugar race. But you're also starting to see, I think, the Trump presidency may be affecting this in ways that we don't fully understand or appreciate yet, too. It may be that the extremity of that situation and the two people in Rokita and Messer who are more to the right may mean that there's a more significant area in the middle for somebody like Mike Braun, to get to that path of victory. But he's got to be careful, because there are already a couple of others who've announced that they're going to be in this race, and if they dilute that middle ground too much, then it does give even more strength, I think, to the yep. further edge.
I think that's where the money comes in, though. The middle ground will be dominated by the person with the resources to communicate
the
message. You can't communicate a message statewide without money.
But we're talking about a significant amount of money, and I know that Mike Braun can generate a lot of money, but you know, we're at $2 and $3 million already in the bank for Rokita and Messer. So we're talking about a lot of money.
I want to ask a little about name recognition. Obviously, it's not exorbitantly high with Messer and Rokita, but it's certainly a lot higher than it is for Mike Braun, who I would imagine is pretty darn low. Those who might know the name might know him because of Steve, his brother, who's the DWD director. But does money overcome that concern?
Money can overcome that concern, because how do you build name ID? You spend money to air spots and do direct mail pieces and create the kind of awareness campaign that would bring somebody from the low single digits statewide in terms of name ID up to what would be appropriate or necessary to win a primary. So that, again, gets us back to a theme we've all sounded here several times, money. John's right. You'd have Rokita and Messer already with a pretty dramatic head start. If you look at the funding reports as of, say, June 30th, I guess, was each had $2 million plus in the bank. So, and this week, Mike Braun said that, in fact, one of the reasons he's doing it now is to make sure that he can start the fundraising now and aggressively pursue fundraising. And he's making no secret of the fact that this gets back to a question you almost started with about, is this opening the race, the contention and the rancor that we've seen among the two most likely the front runners, let's say, sure. declared or undeclared, with Messer and with Rokita. He made no secret of the fact that that's what helped draw him into the race, because he does want to offer a third option.
A third option, but there's technically...
Or fifth or sixth
option. I was just going to say, there's technically five candidates right now, with the presumption that Rokita will be at least the sixth. There's been rumors about other people getting into the race, including notably Curtis Hill, the Attorney General. Do we see... I mean, will this... So let's add in Rokita to the mix, at least right now. Is that the field through to May, or do we see people start to drop off?
Well, there's a high bar to get in. And people don't think that 500 signatures per congressional district is easy. And you have to certify them, so you really need 700 or 800.
Ask Todd Young.
Yeah. And people don't, I mean, unless you've done that, like as a campaign staffer, and I've done it several times, I mean...
It's painful.
It's hard. And the accuracy is always a problem. They wind up tossing hundreds of signatures. You have to really overperform. And it's not easy to do. You got to go do... You have to have an organization in 9 congressional districts to go collect those signatures.
Of course, they're doing it. They have plenty of time, though.
They do have plenty.
Yes, they do.
That's right.
Indiana Health Commissioner Jerome Adams appeared before a U.S. Senate committee this week as he sought confirmation as the U.S. Surgeon General.
Well, thank you, Chairman.
Adams was pressed by Democrats on the Senate committee about whether he'd prioritize science over politics. He gave an unequivocal yes, noting he would listen to what stakeholders and patients are saying. The Indiana physician was nominated by President Trump for the Surgeon General post about a month ago. As Indiana Health Commissioner, Adams led the fight against opioid abuse and helped convince then-Governor Mike Pence to establish syringe exchange programs in Scott County and elsewhere. In the confirmation hearing, Adams also said he'd make community and employer engagement, as well as wellness, tent poles of his agenda.
Well, the Senate unanimously confirmed Adams before the chamber left for its August break. But, Ann Delaney, and this is a question not directed at the Trump administration, but any administration in Washington. Can a Surgeon General really follow through on that promise of prioritizing science over politics?
I hope so. I mean, the frightening part is that we had to ask that question. You know, I mean, belief is fine, and everybody should be entitled to his or her own belief. But the idea that you teach creationism as part of a science curriculum, which some in the Republican Party have advocated in the past, is ridiculous. I mean, science is science. There is such a thing as truth, okay? It isn't alternative facts, or we don't like that particular fact, so therefore our belief trumps your fact. That's what they do. And I thought his answer on that was good, and I hope he can follow through on it. I hope he can follow through on intelligent kinds of policies that discourage teenage pregnancy and smoking and opioid addiction and all of those things. And medical research. I hope he can be an advocate for that as well, because we're on the threshold of some really remarkable breakthroughs that will make a difference in a lot of people's lives if we don't stop the funding and say that we're, you know, playing around with life and we shouldn't do that, and the Calvinist theory that if you're born with a disability, it's you deserved it. You know, those kinds of things don't have any place in our society. And I think his answers were good, and I certainly hope he can stick to his guns or quit, one or the other.
We've seen Jerome Adams do exactly what he said he would try to do as Surgeon General here when he was health commissioner, including notably on the syringe exchanges, pushing past and helping push past some ideological objections of Mike Pence's. Do you think he can replicate that on the bigger stage?
I think he'll certainly try to. I remember he took an oath, and I don't mean the one to become Surgeon General, right? I mean, he took an oath as a doctor, and in my experience with doctors, they all take that pretty seriously. He does have a track record here of pushing against what was, you know, a conservative legislature and a conservative governor, in the Scott County example, first and foremost, of adopting a needle exchange program there when the sheriff didn't want to do it, and the governor didn't want to do it, and the legislature didn't want to do it. Usually that means you're not going to do it, but they did it because the facts prevailed and the evidence, the medical evidence prevailed that is beneficial. And he was the one who had to go and, like, sit down and have a beer with the Scott County sheriff and, like, convince him that was the right thing to do. So I think he can replicate that, and he has a great opportunity here to do it. It's great for
research. He did that, and one of his the tools in his toolbox was a certain style in which he used to go about that, rather than calling news conferences and saying they're, you know, Luddites that are opposing needle exchange and this is an outrage and people are going to die. He did it. He alluded to it in his testimony in the hearing as being more sympathetic and empathetic and using listening and using evidence based outcomes to help carry the day. So that's
he talked
sort
a lot
of
about listening.
Knowledge I was going to say with a silk glove, but you probably don't want to talk about gloves in the context of physicians. But I think that will serve him well. Sorry, Ian. That will serve him well, I think, in this role as well.
So Surgeon General has a 4-year term that he has now been confirmed as. Do you think he finishes that 4-year term?
Well, as Mike said, I hope he does. Or I guess it was Ann said it. She hopes he sticks to his guns or resigns. And I hope he doesn't have to resign, because I do think, as John said, he combines all the best qualities of a winning personality, obviously a very knowledgeable doctor, and I think he's got a great political sense. So I think he brings very needed qualities to Washington, and I hope he is.
It's not just a partisan R versus D politic landscape he faces. Also, if you listen to the hearing, every senator says, I want to make sure you prioritize end-of-life care, gun violence, mental health. So these are constituencies on a wide range, opioid addiction, that almost will be a tougher competition him as these challenges compete for his time and attention than R versus D issues.
All right, moving on. President Trump amped up threats this week to cut off government funding from the Affordable Care Act that helps defray patient costs.
Through the Affordable Care Act, the government provides subsidies for copays and deductibles to help reduce the cost of insurance to consumers. President Trump has threatened to cut off the subsidies for months, ramping up those threats in the wake of the Senate's failure to advance a health care reform bill. Trump says cutting off the subsidies will hasten the collapse of Obamacare and force lawmakers, particularly Democrats who are in the minority in both houses of Congress, to pass a health care measure.
Well, first of all, talking to Joe Donnelly at the state fair opening, he said that talked with Lamar Alexander, the Republican chair of the Health Committee, who said, and he says the Senate will have a bill to protect these subsidies once they come back from their August break. But John Schwanes, this strategy from President Trump to try and put pressure on Congress, is it a good strategy?
Well, if the goal is to collapse the Affordable Care Act, that strategy would work. By withholding the subsidies, it would collapse. The problem, I think, is that it would collapse largely on his head, because even though this is there's some thinking within the White House and perhaps within the mind of Donald Trump that somehow a collapse brought about by these forces and by his actions would cause blame to shift toward Democrats, and I don't think that's the case. When you've been so vocal and you've gone to rallies and you've promised or suggested that I may just cause this thing to collapse, well, guess what? If it collapses, you don't need much to connect the dots about how you got from A to B. So I don't think he would do it. The pressure you noted is building on the part of a bipartisan group within the Senate. Also this week you had the National Governors Association. You had a coalition of hospitals, physicians, pharmacists, drug manufacturers all say, hey, this is not the way to go. This would throw potentially millions of people off of health care and create chaos and instability. And you also had in the courts, because a lot of this is taking place at federal courts, what sparked this initially, you had a federal judge ruling this week that 17 attorneys general could come into the fray effectively on behalf of defending the Affordable Care Act. So right. There were a lot of things lined
particularly
up.
Particularly when it comes to these subsidies.
Right.
To this end, on the pressure side, congressional leaders have now kind of turned the rhetoric towards tax reform as the next big issue they're going to tackle. Do you think when we see them come back in September, do you think tax reform is the first thing on their plate, or do you think they try to return to health care?
Well, it's interesting because they thought they'd have had all of these things knocked down by now and they'd be moving on to something else, and the reality is they haven't been able to handle any of them yet. And I do think that there is a kind of a priority, and in the public's mind, dealing with the Affordable Care Act in some fashion, I think, is first and foremost. So I do think that the pressure, especially with the legislation that Senator Donnelly told you about, there is a feeling in Congress that they need to deal with this. They can't just let it continue to erode. And there is momentum toward fixing it as you change it. And maybe you do them concurrently, or maybe you do one and then the other. But to your question, I don't think they can do tax reform completely until they deal with this question of the Affordable Care Act because of the condition that it's in right now.
To that point, do you think what we might see then is sort of what John mentioned, is it a small fix to stabilize the markets and pushing off the more substantial reform that at least Republicans want to see later on?
I don't think they can get the substantial reform they want to see later on. There are things about the Affordable Care Act that have to be fixed. President Obama's been saying that for 7 years, okay? And most of them deal with the exchanges. And there are 3% of the people covered are on the exchanges. Those have to be fixed, not just for that 3%, but for the rural hospitals and others, and the insurance companies. I mean, the reason there's so little choice on these is because it's so unstable. They're in the risk avoidance business. That's what insurance companies are. And here we are saying, well, it's not just the risk that you're going to provide care to somebody who can't pay. We can pay. We, the government, can pay, and we're not going to.
Right.
So there. And then ask them to go into the market. It is clear that his strategy is not to put, I don't think, pressure on Congress. I think his strategy is to make the Affordable Care Act fail. And he's done that by cutting back on the advertising for that already, and then not enforcing the penalties for not having coverage, and then in addition to that, withholding the subsidies. I think that Lamar Alexander has shown some willingness to have a bipartisan approach to fix the things that need to be fixed. That would be terrific. That would be the first sign of adults in charge in Washington that I've seen in a long time.
To the point, though, I mean, we've seen insurers pull out of the markets increasingly, particularly this year, including in Indiana, where there are, I believe, 4 counties that might not have an option at all on the exchange. And they've cited the uncertainty, certainly including those threats by President Trump that he's been making for months. Is the damage irreparably done already?
Suspending the subsidies will immediately collapse the individual market. I mean, I understand conservative Republicans who are so hungry for Obamacare to be reformed, to either be repealed completely or replaced and reformed with something better. This is not the way to do it. The politics of it don't make sense. John got that is right on. I mean, that falls on our head quickly. And for these 3% of people, I mean, the insurance companies will have no choice but to stop providing coverage. Like they'll have to do it immediately. Now, the exchanges do need. They do need reform because they are eroding, because there is too much unknown risk that insurance companies have to take on when they enter these marketplaces. But stopping the subsidies and letting it collapse isn't the answer. It's certainly not the answer. If you just care about the politics, that is the wrong approach.
Bad politics, but there are also too many healthy people still not getting insurance. The penalties aren't high enough. You know, I mean, I understand that on one level. On the other hand, it used to be our property taxes and others went to pay for them when they finally had some kind of a problem and went in for care. But I think
goes to the idea that there's too much risk for insurance companies. They need healthy people.
Too many older and sicker people are on the insurance and not young and healthy
ones.
That's
the theory.
That's what the insurance companies are saying.
The exchanges replaced the public option. It was a government-facilitated private solution to covering people that aren't covered by an employer, aren't qualified for Medicaid, and can't buy insurance on their own.
All right, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we pose an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should President Trump cut off Obamacare subsidies to hasten its demise and put pressure on Congress? A, yes, or B, no. Last week's question, is Governor Holcomb's new cabinet position just more bureaucracy? 79% say yes, the Department of Workforce Development is sufficient. And 21% say no, it will help focus on a critical area. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Gary, schools have a new state-appointed emergency manager this week as Muncie Schools, under an emergency manager already, had to cancel its first week of classes essentially this year due to transportation issues.
Northwest Indiana native Peggy Hinckley will lead a team from a Florida-based consulting group as she takes over control of the Gary Community School Corporation. The state authorized the takeover this past legislative session in response to the corporation's severe budget issues. Hinckley and her team will have only informal oversight from a local advisory board and a state panel. Muncie Schools also have an emergency manager created by the same legislation that addressed Gary, but the school year in the Delaware County city isn't off to a great start. The corporation hired a new bus company this year that promised to pick up the same amount of kids in half the routes for half the price. But the first day of school went so poorly, the district canceled the second day of classes to address the issue.
Actually, Muncie then canceled both. Now, first day of school Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, they had to cancel all 3 days because of these transportation issues. But, John, there were obvious crises and are obvious crises in Gary and Muncie. But are you comfortable with the state taking over an entire school corporation?
You know, that's a very difficult thing because you want to have the schools dealt with at the local level if possible. But you're talking with, particularly in Gary, a system that's had intractable problems for a long time. They've had a shrinking property tax base. They've had a shrinking student base. They've got all of these additional costs. And we've seen that to a great extent in Muncie as well. You've got established industrial cities that have lost tax base, have lost population, and they've got, you know, fixed costs that are there, and they've got increased challenges because they can't raise additional revenue. So in these cases, you really do need to have some kind of administration from the outside. It's a, you know, to what degree, you know, do you want them making calls on personnel? No, I don't think the state should be making individual calls on personnel, but as far as, you know, working through the financial issues and trying to find ways to creatively refinance or find a better transportation system or help the school district raise additional revenue through a successful referendum, which, you know, neither one of these districts have been able to do, I think that's a good middle ground.
Whenever you see something like this happen, there's always some people who will go, well, if there, then here. Do you think people are going to be long-term comfortable with the state now going to that next step of taking over an entire corporation as opposed to just an individual school?
Well, I don't think anyone would tell you that it's an ideal situation. As
no.
John suggested, when you have the elected members, say, of the school board, the ostensibly the governing body, sitting in the audience listening to lawmakers explain how this is going to unfold, that's probably not a good thing. But what option do you have? I mean, in the case of Gary, with a debt of in excess of $100 million, only 30 of it to the state, you could forgive the state's the state could forgive its portion of the debt, but that still leaves $70 million. I mean, the system would collapse. So, something's got to happen. I don't know. I mean, expand vouchers to public school students. I mean, I don't know where they have to be extra big vouchers,
and
I guess, to cover the.
well, I want to three on one.
I want to ask.
It's not ideal, but it's.
Yeah.
I don't know what the option is.
I want to ask a little bit about the oversight here. So, for instance, in Gary, the DUOP board technically has an oversight role. This local advisory, so the local folks have a role, but they can't actually force the emergency manager to do anything. It's they can raise their hands and say, hey, but what about this? Is that an issue too, that really this emergency manager has incredibly broad powers?
Yeah, but it takes a long time to get here. A long time. I mean, we've been talking about the stressed unit appeals board has been talking, it has been in Gary for what, a decade? So from a comfort level, if the standard is, are we comfortable with this? The answer is no. Nobody's comfortable with this. Ideally, the state just puts this off on the locals, and the locals are in charge. That is ideal. What's not ideal is kids going through a failing system for years or decades.
Is this really the only solution they were left with?
I have some concern with not necessarily the solution, but the person appointed for this. This person left IPS abruptly when there are questions raised by board members about conflict of interest. She has an association with Charter Schools USA. Yeah. Charter Schools USA is failing in Howe High School and Manual High School, and once she has the association with them, suddenly it's they're given another year or two to continue yeah. failing, and we're moving them up there. Part of the problem is there are too many of these charter schools in Gary and in Indianapolis, and we're not holding them accountable. When they fail, we renew their contracts. And I have a fundamental problem with that, okay? The whole purpose behind the both the charter schools, as I understood it, and the vouchers, was to move kids from failing schools to good performing schools. Instead, we're keeping them in failing schools that we're paying for well, with very little
maybe
supervision.
Maybe charters had a slightly different. It was to give
well,
public
and we're
going to
find out.
Right.
It'll be another year before.
And
it'll be another year before we find out what they want to do with Charter Schools USA here in Indianapolis. Well, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwanis of Indiana Lawmakers, and John Katzenberger, President of the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at wfyi.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Ice Miller is proud to support Indiana Week in Review. Ice Miller, with a 100-year tradition of learning what is important to clients and strategizing with them toward a common goal. Today, Ice Miller continues its commitment to help clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.